I'm Chris Benda, Theological Librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and I'd like to welcome you to another in a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. Today I'll be talking with Melissa Snar, Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at the Divinity School and Associate Professor of Ethics and Society, about her recently published book, All You That Labor, Religion and Ethics in the Living Wage Movement. Melissa, thanks for being willing to do this interview.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate it.
How did you get interested in the living wage movement?
It's interesting. I think there are multiple vectors to influence why a living wage movement. But I grew up fairly conservative religiously. But in college, was engaged with a group, Evangelicals for Social Action, that really began to draw me theologically to think about poverty in terms of theological categories. And so I spent much of my college time really trying to figure out what are some of the root causes of poverty, why are there not stronger movements or commitments to changing inequity in the world. So I left college with that, still with that kind of question, because college was a really transformative experience for me. And I entered into my master's and PhD programs, really beginning to try to think about what it takes politically to change economic injustice. And during that time, I both got interested in campaign finance reform, and I started working with a group of workers at Emory University when I was running what was called a servant leadership program. And so there were several staffers, and many of them in the maintenance department, that we did leadership trainings for. And through conversation with them, began to understand even this very wealthy institution, the wages for the times that they had been there were really inadequate to their family needs. That connected me. There was just a start of organizing in Atlanta around a municipal living wage ordinance. And so I met with the woman who was running that and went to one of the first trainings for the Atlanta Living Wage Movement. And eventually, students of mine in the Servant Leadership Program started the Emory Living Wage Campaign and then also did organizing in the city for the Living Wage Ordinance as well. So really it was a transformation theologically, a kind of changing of my focus of what I thought it meant to change the world, to give testimony, and then intersecting folks who began to really explain to me, even though they had been playing by the rules, so to speak, they were having an extremely hard time just surviving, even at institutions that were thriving in other ways. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the trajectory into the living wage movement. And then from when I moved from Atlanta, Vanderbilt had a student living wage campaign that was already kind of getting off the ground, and so became involved in that. And then also after the kind of first round of Vanderbilt Living Wage Campaign, worked with other activists in the area to start the Davidson County Living Wage Campaign as well.
Your book is an analysis of specifically of the involvement of religious people and organizations in the living wage movement. But I want to spend most of our time talking about that. But I wanted to ask first, what is a living wage?
Right. That is the hotly contested question. And the interesting thing about that question is because it's not always clearly defined, you can't just give a number that applies across the United States or whatever. A lot of opponents of living wage will say, well, you can't really define living wage. And to a certain extent, they're correct that there's a real range in definitions of living wage. But I would say at the minimal level, a living wage is meant to signify those who work full-time are able to take care of their most basic needs, And this includes housing, transportation, childcare, healthcare, food, utilities, not eating out, not vacations, not entertainment or anything of that sort, but just basic needs that they should be able, through the work of a full-time job, to be able to pay for that for themselves and any dependents. And there are arguments about, well, do you calculate it off of two adults in a household and two children, or one adult and two children? And so there's some debate around that. But even if you looked at the ideal, quote-unquote, family model in the U.S. of two adults in the home and then two children, that's what a lot of living wage activists have said. Okay, what are the basic needs there? And doing the divisions according to working full-time, what would they need to make to be able to survive? Not even be able to save for a home or any of that sort, but just survive. So that's probably the most basic definition. Although some groups have, and they rarely call it living wage, but some activists have said, just at least get the wage above the federal poverty line. That to me is not an actual living wage. I mean, that's not even really subsistence, hardly at that point. And then there are other activists that say a living wage should have an even higher range, in the sense of being able to save for emergencies, to be able to occasionally eat out, things of that sort. So what would it mean to be able to be a fuller participant in society? And a lot of those folks will put it right now, because of the way federal poverty guidelines are constructed, at about 200% of the poverty line. And so you'll see a lot of activists that will go with a range between 150 and 200% of the federal poverty line, just because the federal poverty line is constantly adjusted by inflation as well. But in the end, a living wage is about, if you work full time, you should be able to pay for your basic necessities out of that those wages being earned. And it's not only the monetary, but also the kind of dignity component of that. And so that's part of the stories. For example, a lot of times, even around Vanderbilt's living wage campaign, interviewing folks who are living in homeless shelters at the same time they're working full-time on campus. Okay, what's going on there? What's the result that ended in that situation? And so that's part of the living wage argument as well.
You argue that the contributions of religious activists to the living wage movement haven't been adequately noticed, talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
I think there are a number of reasons, and I would say they particularly haven't been talked about by serious academics, or I would say actually sociologists and a lot of folks who study social movements regularly. And there's a lot of speculation and theorizing around why that is. And in fact, Christian Smith, who's a sociologist who's now at Notre Dame, wrote this really important article, I think it was in 99, about why social movement theory neglects analyzing religion. And I think he had some really important points within that there, within sociology, there had been there's a generation that really was raised on secularization theory, and a particular kind of secularization theory that really thought religion was going to disappear, or at least be highly privatized. And so the kind of hangover of the secularization theory and training, even though secularization theory has morphed now, that's still been trying to even recognize the role of religion in the public sphere has been difficult for folks. And if they do recognize it, it's either, oh yeah, well, the Black Civil Rights Movement, we all know that, or it's over in Iran with the Iranian Revolution or something like that sort. It's not kind of the everyday now occurrences. Mm-hmm. Another part of that is those who talk about religion, oftentimes there's particularly because the 80s and early 90s were so strong in the on the Christian right analysis, that there's really an assumption that religion is mostly a conserving or kind of protective of more traditional or elite practices. And so some analysis just has a hard time recognizing when religion is progressive. And that's, most of the time you have to think about when people are trained. And so you have to kind of be retrained out of that. So those folks who got their PhDs in the 90s or so, were really, their examples of religion were the Christian right. And so to see the living wage movement, if it doesn't say it's religious to begin with, oftentimes takes some digging. Even though the living wage movement, the first living grassroots living wage activism, emerged out of faith-based community organizing, so an Industrial Areas Foundation organization in Baltimore of some 40-some-odd churches, primarily African-American, who they saw as Baltimore's downtown redevelopment strategies were happening, that actually what was being created were these minimum wage jobs that now people were employed, but they were still full-time folks were showing up in soup kitchens and clothes closets for rental assistance at these dramatic numbers. And so it was actually this group of pastors and the leadership model within that faith-based community organizing that has a Saul Alinsky background to it that really did the first move towards the living wage concept, kind of as a new, kind of the new living wage movement. There was a living wage, which was the minimum wage movement in the progressive era, but this is another manifestation. And then also, I think, depending on where you're located to do your research, there's a way in which you can see most of the organizing being dominated by maybe more secular figures, like Jobs with Justice organizations, or unions. When you look at some of the medium-sized cities, you begin to see the leadership infrastructure, I think, looks a little different than in, say, Chicago or New York or something of that sort, that or Boston, that has, they have really deep union traditions, even there, the religious components have been very important as well. But it kind of matters, I think, sometimes where you're located too, to see what's happening. But there are academic reasons, and there are probably even more to go into on that front. But then there are also activist reasons in the kind of reporting of activism that sometimes overlook or minimize the role of religious organizations and religious activists as well.
And then the geographic reasons, that was another question that I wanted to ask. Your book focuses on Nashville, Atlanta, as we've already heard, two places where you've lived, Memphis, and San Diego, to give a slightly different geographic location. And you've just mentioned partly why the North might be different. What do you gain and lose by focusing on the four cities that you've picked, which tend to be, at least three of them tend to be southern, and the other one is kind of, way out in the west.
It's southern in its own sense, but it's interesting because I open with the Baltimore story, but that's been written about a lot more, and it's much much further back. And I also have met with a few of the leaders in New Haven, Connecticut, and that's actually a very interesting story as well, that their living wage campaign was really co-led by a UCC minister, a white woman, graduate of Yale Divinity School, and then a black Pentecostal male pastor who was also a community organizer. And then they really reached out to the Puerto Rican community there. And part of their narrative about their work was, yes, we had strong union backing, but what opened the doors to really grassroots organizing that wasn't seen as coming from the sometimes oppressive charity of Yale University, because it usually comes with research strings attached. To really get a grassroots, it actually was a pastor's network that opened up to the grassroots organizing. But I didn't have the same ethnographic field notes for that. But I do think there's definitely some losses and gains in where I did my participatory research and who was kind of left out in the conversations. And just to add in there, though, I did observe at national conventions for interfaith worker justice for a number of years, where you get the gathered stories from multiple places as well. But part of it is, I think religious organizations and activists are particularly important in right-to-work states, in cities and states that don't have the same kind of depth of a union base or alternative progressive institutions that have been doing this kind of work and have deep roots in the community. And so particularly looking at Atlanta, Nashville, and Memphis, even though Atlanta had some very interesting alliances with feminist organizations, with their central labor council was fairly strong in their organizing, the religious community at very key points was essential. That kind of moral voice really brought together some diverse constituencies that were important. And as I relate in the book, in Nashville, because at the city level, because the union Central Labor Council didn't back the eventual winner of the mayoral race, an advisor to the of the mayor's said to the campaign, you've got to lead with your religious voice because he's not talking to the union folks right now. That's resolved itself for the second term. But so there really was a sense of a real leadership vacuum. Mm-hmm. And Memphis has been led by an incredible Methodist woman organizer that has cut across denominational and racial and economic boundaries for the organizing there in a way that's been very important. So I think the particular labor history of the South is important and often gets overlooked in writing about labor, in writing about worker justice, or worker justice stuff gets taken up into labor unions as the only way to analyze it. And that loses a lot of the worker justice organizing that certainly has allies in labor unions here, but labor unions aren't necessarily the strongest way to understand what's going on in worker justice. And then San Diego is a really interesting place because it's a very conservative city. So again, a fairly conservative environment, although very different in ethnic demographics, but it really was the Catholic Church, and then they have a Jewish executive director at Interfaith Worker Justice that brought together a very unique coalition that also knew how to lobby in moral terms that really changed the nature of the debate out there. So I think what the book does help do is look at, well, in particularly conservative regions, and in particular regions that aren't terribly strong in terms of a history of labor organizing, who's there and doing this kind of worker justice work? And I think that story can get left out in a lot of other places. Although even in L.A., the religious community has been really central in a lot of their labor struggles, and they have a much stronger labor base there. What you do lose is, in this book, is as much in-depth wrestling with a kind of clash between maybe sometimes more secular union approaches, more secular progressive anti-racism work, and religious communities. In a way, to draw on religion to do public work in Atlanta, Nashville, Memphis is not unsurprising. And in really, oftentimes in San Diego even. But that can be more surprising in some other context. And so that kind of negotiation of intra-movement framing, maybe you don't get as rich ethnographic detail as well. So it may not satisfy the folks who come from what seems like a more staunchly secularized living wage city or something of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
So that's some of the strengths and the weaknesses as well.
Great. Early in your book, you bring up a concept that you call moral agency, which plays a big part in your discussion. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you mean by moral agency and how it relates to the analysis that you make of religious activism.
Well, as an ethicist, moral agency is one of our favorite key terms. And in many ways, I would say that moral agency is about the moral judgment, the moral commitment to really address the right and the good. Or another way to say it, maybe more simply, is that do people have the capacity and the commitment to work for their own and other people's needs and rights? So what is it that enables folks to actually see that there's something going on that's amiss and needs to be corrected, or something that needs to be fortified because it's doing really important work in the community? And so what enables them to see that? But also, for me, moral agency is what enables someone to actually commit and work towards change as well. And that's where I think looking at institutions and how they form people, or I would say deform people, for moral agency is incredibly important. We're all always being socialized into certain kinds of practices. And so the major institutions that a person is involved with, whether they be workplace or congregation or school, or we could talk about multiple kinds of institutions, how are they being formed to analyze the world around them and to commit to working towards the good of themselves and others in that kind of balanced way? So moral agency does a lot of work for ethicists, and it does a lot of work in here. And I would say also there's a way in which I want to always tie moral agency to political agency. So you can act within your moral agency, not necessarily always through political channels, but I think that's a particularly important manifestation of moral agency in thinking about how you change and advocate for yourselves and others in the society that you're in that has a decidedly political nature to it. So I think there's a kind of political moral agency, an economic moral agency, but it's all really grounded in this deep formation of being able to have the capacity and the commitment to really work for the good and address the needs of yourself and others in society.
We'll turn now to a little bit more detailed discussion of the book. And I just want to start off, I guess, with talking about or asking you about some of the practices that you talk about that are associated with the living wage movement. The bulk of your book discusses these practices, and I thought we'd kind of go through each one and highlight some aspect of each one of them. And the first one that I wanted to talk to you about is the race. You talk about bridge building and political engagement in racialized economies. But what I wanted to do is just quote you and then ask you a question. In this chapter on race in relation to the living wage movement, You say actually a couple of times the following: while Sunday morning or Friday prayer or Saturday Shabbat, for that matter, is still the most segregated time in America, Tuesday night council meetings, where the living wage movement is involved, present a different picture. The living wage movement is overall one of the more racially and ethnically diverse movements in recent social movement history, and religious organizations regularly take the lead in cultivating this diversity. So I wonder, it strikes me that there's a contradiction here. So I wonder if you could talk about that. How do largely segregated religious institutions help to produce a racially and ethnically diverse social movement? And then in turn, what influences does that social movement have on those religious institutions, particularly in terms of the issue of race?
Well, it's not a contradiction, it's a paradox.
Okay.
no, but it is, yeah. It's one of the fascinating pieces to me of the living wage movement and worker justice movement, I think, more broadly. And at one level, this is a movement that has significant buy-in of what in social movement theory is often called direct beneficiaries, and then the kind of conscience adherence to the movement as well, which is sometimes harder to do with more abstract issues like nuclear freeze or, even campaign finance reform. It's really hard to think, okay, in concrete, short term, who are the beneficiaries of this? And so you oftentimes get much more of a level of conscious adherence, which, because conscious adherents often are those who are a little bit higher up the socioeconomic scale, that tends then to also equate to a less diverse population.
Now, conscience, you mean people who, for conscience reasons,
right,
not necessarily that they feel that they are particularly directly affected by this.
So I would say my own entry into thinking about worker justice issues was coming out of a faith tradition that really pressed me to think about poverty issues, and that as part of what it meant to be a disciple was to think about why is there such great injustice in the world, and what is the role of what is my contribution and role in that. So even though, relatively speaking, I was relatively secure financially through most of my life. So that conscious adherent, and not that those adherents don't do an enormous amount of work, but there are movements that can be very conscious adherent dominated. But this is a case in a lot of labor organizing. You get folks further down the socioeconomic scale because they're folks who are direct beneficiaries. If I lobby for this, my paycheck changes. And that 50 cents, I know what that 50 cents an hour means in a different sort of way. So there's that. But there's also this is the paradox that I find most interesting. It's troublesome and hopeful at the same time. But congregations are largely homogeneous. Of course, you get stories now of healthy, thriving, mixed race, ethnicity congregations, mixed class congregations as well. But they're largely homogeneous along race and even along in ethnicity and along class. And that could be seen and is mostly seen as a negative. But the irony is that actually allows for a certain kind of leadership development of folks who are in those homogenous communities that might not happen in more diverse institutions. So, for example, a janitorial specialist at Vanderbilt is probably not going to have the same leadership opportunities, education opportunities, investment in their authority in this setting because of the range of education degrees, of socioeconomic standing, things of that sort that are present in the institution. So even if they're treated well, there's not necessarily a lot of diversity in their engagement in the institution and in the forms of engagement. Where that same janitor in their congregation may be also the choir director or leading the pastoral, the personnel committee, or be organizing vacation Bible school in the nights of the summer. And so because there's a more of a homogeneity, there's actually more leadership opportunity and more building of civic skills that happen. And these are long studies from different political scientists and even Robert Bella and some other folks. And so that paradox of, even though there is definitely, I think, brokenness and I would say sin in the isolation of homogeneous congregations from each other, there is actually a political opportunity there for folks who would normally be left out of developing leadership and civic skills in other institutions that don't take them, that they're not as mobile in. So that's some of what you also see in the living wage movement, that it wasn't necessarily the congregational level that pulled together this really diverse movement, but it was these kind of mid-level, like interfaith worker justice organizations that weren't tied to denomination necessarily or anything, that then drew leaders from multiple congregations. Mm. And because of that, on a Tuesday night, the room is more diverse than you probably ever see in almost any other religious gathering. Because there was a mediating institution that then drew from these homogeneous congregations who had been developing their own leaders in different ways. And I remember the stories in the book, but I remember very prominently being at the Atlanta City Council meeting, and there was a raising of, they asked to folks to identify which organizations that they were with, and so there were folks who raised their hand for unions. They all had on the different colored shirts. Then you had the Chamber of Commerce folks and Delta Airlines, who were all in their suits, and they're mostly white guys in their suits. And then I said, and those who are associated with the religious community, and all of these hands went up from this just ragtag kind of diverse folks, but then also some of the union members, particularly SEIU. And one of the women who got up to do her kind of, I would say, testimony, she worked in custodial services, gave this incredible story. And part of the conversation afterwards was how she had been trained to give her testimony for years. Mm. So she knew how to do that. That's one of the things that she did in her church. And so thinking about that wasn't necessarily a skill that was cultivated when she was working at the airport. They weren't asking her to not necessarily lead leadership team meetings in the same sort of way, but that was something that her church was continually asking her to do. And so that kind of skill set is something that's significant. So the question of whether and how the living wage movement experiences feedback into congregations, it's more difficult. Mm. I mean, I think there's such, congregations have their own institutional histories, their own spaces, their own cultures, that I think it's hard to get some of that to mean that we'll be moving towards more multiracial, multi-class congregations. And then the pragmatist in me at points says, and if we do, will it just reproduce a kind of elitism in the midst of that? What it has produced is new kinds of alliances in terms of worker justice in cities, where the leadership is quite diverse in terms of, I would say, even looking at this is a particular national case, when there was a English-only bill that was passed up, that there are ways in which these are now leaders who have worked with each other on multiple different issues. And so in that sense, they can bring together. And oftentimes, as well with faith-based community organizing networks, it's the same thing of, is there another middle kind of space where folks come together that still has its own religious sensibilities and that are really important? And does that disrupt over time some of the homogeneity of their home congregations? I'm not sure. Just analytically, I'm not sure. Hopeful, but analytically, I don't have proof on that to that extent.
Another practice you talk about in your book is, speaking of leadership, but in this case, gendered leadership development. And you note about the make a note about the feminization of grassroots organizing. You say more than half of all community organizers are women, and half of their board members are women as well, which would seem to be a cause for celebration. But then you talk about the economic costs of this kind of involvement. Can you talk a little bit about those costs and how religious organizations actually make the situation worse, and maybe some ways in which there's some optimism or hope about how things could get better?
And I would say, more specifically, I'm talking about faith-based community organizers. So whether they're in faith, congregation-based community organizing networks like Industrial Areas Foundation or PICO or some others. And then particularly the network I analyzed the most, which was Interfaith Worker Justice. And it's quite clear how women-led this organizing is. It's remarkable. And it's wonderful because there are great stories about women talking about, I had no idea I had this capacity for political organizing and speech and things of that sort. And so there's a tremendous positive with this. And Kim Bobo at Interfaith Worker Justice has done a great job really raising up a generation of women leaders that are now working in all sorts of different contexts in different parts of worker justice movements. But one of the problems is that community organizing is incredibly hard, unpredictable work that that what you begin to see and what folks talked about over and over was you get young women organizers in, they're there until they're probably about 27 or 28, and then they burn out, they drop out. Sometimes they come back late 30s, 40s. But there are tremendous pressures. If the reality is still, this isn't across the board, but it's mostly true, women are the primary caregivers, both for children and for elderly parents. And that is usually a key time when that comes into play. And if you think about the way community organizing works, you're doing mostly nights, weekends. You have to have the flexibility when you're in the worker justice movement, particularly, to be outside of everyone's kind of normal work schedule. That makes it extremely hard to find daycare or any sort of kind of cooperative child or elder care environment. They also tend to work for very small organizations that have, most of them do not have retirement plans. Some of them have health care, but it's usually just for them and not a family health care plan. So there are all these kind of factors that are in place that make it very difficult to do this, sustain this kind of organizing work. And in fact, that's one of the reasons even in labor organizing for a long time, they just didn't think women could do it because of all of the necessity to be able to move from campaign to campaign and things of that sort. I would say, religiously, one of the things that undergirds this that's really difficult is the sense in which, oh, you shouldn't be making that much money anyway because, oh, isn't it wonderful you're serving the poor? You're serving the poor. And it's almost as if we have drafted involuntarily a lot of these female community organizers into kind of a St. Francis of Assisi order or something, where they're supposed to give up all of their earthly possessions. And so this sense in which when religious institutions contract the meaning of serving the poor to certain designated people who have a special call, I think they also place then an expectation that these folks will take on the burden of that in almost a monastic sense, which is really, it's not coherent with the calling of those community organizers, nor do I think it's coherent with the church's mission, where everybody is called to care for the poor and work and organize for the poor in different ways. But there's a way in which you can kind of isolate off into a kind of missional sense of what this is as a missionary. We send a missionary to go out for us, and they're so amazing because what they can live off of is remarkable. Well, that doesn't actually sustain a deep commitment to transform institutions and transform political life. And I think in many ways that's also true with women taking on the care of communities and the expectations that you can kind of carry that burden of care in ways that I think are still gendered. I may not always be, but they still are gendered to a large extent. So that's where I think the feminization of organizing connects in with oftentimes a religious ideology that thinks of those who serve the poor should also be voluntarily poor. And that's actually, that's rare in our religious traditions that that is equated, that those who serve the poor have to be voluntarily poor. Most of our traditions actually would move against that. So that's a deep concern that kind of keeps, and then the level of sacrifice that we often expect out of religious traditions of women who are caring for communities can sometimes add to the burden of that organizing. The nice thing about it is that women are dropping out, in part because they have enough of a sense of this is not sustainable. And they're also talking back on how do you make it sustainable. And so there are some ideas coming out of organizers and feminist organizations that actually have partnered with religious organizations that do community organizing to think about how you can do shared pools for retirement. How do you do healthcare in a different kind of configuration? And also thinking about how do you build in sabbaticals for organizers and that kind of self-care as well. But one of the things I think is very important is for those denominations who can think towards this is ordaining people into community organizing so they're part of a benefits system. And, of course, this doesn't apply to some denominations like my Alliance of Baptist tradition, but there are many denominations that if you could be ordained into this without having to serve a congregation, but rather saw this as that might be able to buy into this into the system. But overall, it also means really looking carefully at what we expect of community organizers in relation to our religious traditions and who do we ask to take up the burdens of caring for the poor and working with them as well, I think are important.
You also talk about a different kind of practice other than what we've been talking about before, which is the use of religious ritual in the living wage movement. How does ritual enhance the moral agency that you were talking about earlier of the people that are involved in the movement? And I'm wondering, I'm always bringing in the negative too, I guess, or versus, but you know, how does ritual potentially impede the movement?
And I think both sides of that are important to consider. I think oftentimes in the book, I want to give long pause around the positive dimensions of religious involvement because I actually don't think they get as much analysis as they deserve. That there's so often a quick move to, oh, but isn't this kind of offensive in the public square and things of that sort, that we don't pause long enough to see, okay, what's the depth of what's going on here and how's it contributing substantially to positive change as well? But I will address the cautionary notes as well. I think ritual contributes to the moral agency of particularly of people of faith who are involved in the living wage movement in many different ways. I think I probably named like six or something in that chapter. But a couple that I think are really important to think about is religious ritual is this very interesting, oftentimes first step into a community or into a new sense of identity. So while one of the things that social movement theory looks at a lot is, and it's kind of obvious by now, is it's people don't go from getting an email to come to a rally to being arrested that same day and going on a hunger strike. It doesn't kind of work that way. But it's a slow, even organizing and activism is a slow socialization. And oftentimes, familiar ritual from a religious tradition placed in another setting provides a bridge into a place that maybe someone hadn't thought about their faith quite in that way. And there's also a way in which if you can walk in and sing "We Will Not Be Moved" in the kind of the central atrium of the city council, that's often, for folks who haven't done a lot of activism, much easier than coming in with a picket shout or, you know, locking yourself to a bench or something of that sort. There's a way in which it invites those who don't have deep experience in this kind of activism or political persuasion world to slowly see what their faith means in this context. I also think it's incredibly important that it can also transform others who are seeing it, kind of claiming the presence of the sacred in places that we normally don't expect it. So one of the kind of famous stories by now in the worker justice movement is in LA during a hotel workers campaign to sign contracts. There were several area clergy who went in to have coffee in a restaurant at a hotel. And they got their coffee, and when they received their coffee, they would stand up one by one and give a 3 to 5 minute homily on worker justice in the middle of the restaurant. And when they finally, you know, three or four of them did it, and then they left, and to the applause of some of the servers, the astonishment of those who were in the hotel, and of course the mortification of some of the management. But there was a way in which they said, this is also a place to think about God and what God desires and the justice that God desires. So it reclaims some spaces that we've kind of written off from a religious or an ethical gaze. And that, I think that can be really powerful and important. But the final thing that I think is really important in this, in the diversity of this movement, especially when you're thinking of a lot of low-wage workers, one of the things that you have to talk about is there are many low-wage workers, and by no means all, but many of them who don't have the same education levels. Some of them have language issues because of immigration. Some of them have disabilities or that are also in play. And so political speech is not always the best way for them to engage politically. Mm-hmm. But whether or not your English is great, you can wash, your feet can be washed and you can wash the feet of another in front of City Hall. You can deliver milk and honey or bitter herbs to the manager of a hotel that won't sign a contract or does sign a contract for milk and honey. And there's a way in which that kind of level of participation is very important too. So it's not just folks who don't feel comfortable speaking, who maybe don't have the experience, but those who have, they have some barriers to participation. Ritual opens up a space in a different sort of way, and you see this a lot in the prayers that are done in different actions and things of that sort. So all of that, I think, there are other ways in which ritual is important for contributing to moral agency. But I think those are three of the ways that I think are very important. And particularly that last part, I think we forget how much we rely on speech capacity to have a right to politically participate in the U.S. And I don't think that's true everywhere in the world. But the linguistic capacities that we expect for someone to be able to be a self-advocate are very high in the U.S., and ritual provides another way in which folks can engage politically, be bodily present. It also draws attention to bodies in a way that speech can be abstracted. And so all of those capacities, I think, are important to kind of stretch who can be involved in the political process as well.
Mm-hmm. And so these are all positive
things. Oh, the negative.
You do such a good job in the book of as you say, of bringing in both sides. I just want to make sure that we...
No, absolutely. And a few of the things I do talk about extensively is this way in which ritual can become just it's just theater, that it becomes untethered from the depth of religious tradition, and it is done without realizing the complexity of what it means to be engaged in religious ritual, and also that ritual is placed in a larger trajectory, or I should say a larger liturgy, and even liturgical calendar, the sense in which the call for repentance is always tied to forgiveness. And oftentimes when you pull one ritual out and use it for just political theater, you forget the whole of the liturgical rhythm that is meant to restore wholeness. Mm. So there's that danger. There's also a way in which folks can tell after a while when you're just performing it to perform it. And I give some examples of that in the book as well. When it's clear it's becoming a political rally and has very little to do with actual roots in a religious tradition. And so there's a way in which that you have to renew the ground of religious ritual in faith communities or intentional faith communities. And that can be congregations or it could be Catholic worker places or, you know, others. But you have to, I think, renew and keep close to the roots of the religious traditions, so you're not kind of running off the fumes of religious ritual that's really been kind of torn from its roots in many ways. And it also can mean that you're not held accountable to the fullness of religious life when you're just pulling one ritual out. You know, oh, we've got the bitter herbs thing that we do, you know, 14 times a year, and bitter herbs are not the end of the story in a religious tradition. And I think that's very important because I also think it's important for activists to realize and to be sustained by even the liturgical nature of activism. There are different seasons to it, and they need to be seen together. And so really pushing towards that wholeness. The other side of it is it can just look like you're trying, for those who are not religiously affiliated, it can be deeply alienating if that's the whole of the movement. And so thinking about the complexity of who's in the movement is very important, and the multiplicity of rituals, some of which may not be religious at all. And puppeteering at the World Trade Organization protest is its own kind of, it has its own ritual and things of that sort to it. So thinking about not alienating others in the movement while still claiming identity, and then not just at some point becoming almost a parody mm-hmm. of your own faith after a while as well.
I wanted to make sure that I asked you about one of the discussions in your book that was very interesting to me, which was your discussion of interdependence, mm-hmm. which is actually earlier on in the book than what we've mm-hmm. been discussing. One of the things that worries you about the living wage movement is the discourse on independent economic freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about how that discourse is tempered by the realization that the government has a role in
mm-hmm.
economic health. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what economic assumptions you see behind the living wage movement as a whole, and why you find them a little bit problematic.
Well, and I'll have to say that not all of the living wage movement does this, but there are. So when I was talking at the very beginning about definition of living wage, some folks will actually within the movement will define a living wage as a wage that allows you to not be reliant on government handouts or not reliant on government benefits. So what gets you off of Section 8, food stamps, things of that sort, which I understand is a background conversation, but it begins to set up that the problem is there's a problem that people are reliant on government, and that will always be a problem, kind of setting that up as always a negative.
Mm.
And it also covers over how much middle, upper middle, even elites are dependent on government. So I finished my taxes yesterday. My mortgage tax and my mortgage tax break is incredibly significant. And that is actually probably the biggest welfare program that there is. And so there's a way in which thinking about how reliant we are on food, just our dailiness is dependent upon government regulation of food, of water, our streets, we could go on and on. That what it does is it names a certain segment of society as being those who are dependent upon government, and not understanding the myriad ways we're all deeply dependent on government. For good, for ill. So it has a stigmatization problem in there, too. But it sets up some of those who will work off of these, that kind of phraseology, which is very powerful as a framing approach in public discourse to say, you know, all we're saying is that people who work full-time should receive wages that, you know, means that they don't have to be dependent on the government. So this sense of American individualism and independence is very persuasive in the political sphere for those who are kind of wavering on wage concerns. But in the end, even those who will say, realizing that we need the government to help us set wage limits and things of that sort, but ultimately it's moving towards this independence, I think really doesn't help us see the complexity of how our economy works. And the political economy that defines our everyday existence. And so it kind of sets out as a goal economic independence in a way in which we're never economically independent from each other. We're always deeply dependent on multiple kinds of economic relationships with each other. So I think it not only stigmatizes, but it also doesn't do solid analytical work around how we actually do exist in an economy, how we do exist in particularly this political economy. And then in the end, theologically, I don't think independence is a strong theological goal. Of course, I will have some more conservative theological disagreements with that. But I think at heart, when we look at, particularly in the Christian tradition, but this is also true in multiple other religious traditions, that interdependence, a healthy interdependence, is actually the theological vision of right relationship and even righteousness. And some people will draw that even into the Trinitarian formulation of what does it mean to be, yes, to have our own identities in some ways, to do kind of distinct kinds of work, but to recognize that we are because of the other, and that never goes away. And so I think it, when you begin to trumpet this story of independence and freedom from the government economically, it also has this tail end to it that sets that up almost, particularly when it's coming from religious activists, as if that is a theological idea, ideal, and I just don't think it is. Mm-hmm. I think healthy interdependence is, and we can talk about what healthy means, but we need to be working at that level, not a myth of independence from each other.
Mm-hmm.
So I think on several different levels it can be a problem. Not everyone does that, but there's definitely a strain of framing within the movement that will occur pretty regularly. Those are the points that I had to press back with some of my friends on. I don't think that's the way you want to frame it. And there are activists within the movement that also push back on that framing as well, regularly, and have been in meetings where that's been a conversation topic as well.
For the final question, I wanted to talk about a movement that actually started up, I guess, around the time this book was published, which is Occupy Wall Street and all of the sort of offshoots that have appeared all over the country, even the world.
Yeah.
How do you see, or do you see any kind of connections between this new movement and the living wage movement that you talk about in your book? And my sense from reading your book was that the living wage movement in some ways, and correct me if I'm wrong, in some ways kind of has plateaued, and it's maybe lost some momentum. If that's the case, do you see ways in which Occupy Wall Street, which maybe some people would say has plateaued as well, I don't know, some ways in which that movement might help energize, or the two might, come together in some way?
Well, one of the things I say at the end of the book is that I really see the living wage movement as a gateway movement into other worker justice issues, and that really it's probably even better to look at the worker justice movement and the living wage movement being in the last 15 years the most prominent. And even if you just look at kind of the spikes in the number of articles over time, it's amazing to see the peaks and now kind of the kind of stabilizing, in part because all of the easy victories have already been won in the living wage movement, and the ones that are happening now are like Nashville, where there's actually a metro charter that doesn't allow the metro council to set wage limits, and so it has to come through another back door. And then you have in Georgia, where the state legislature actually banned and so undid all of the local living wage ordinances. And actually, that's the state legislature has tried to do that three times already to negate Memphis's living wage ordinance as well. So the battles have shifted, and there's not a lot of new battles that are easy battles. But what it has shifted into are issues like wage theft, which is becoming more and more prominent. And actually the Workers' Dignity Project in Nashville is like so many others who now what they're doing is recovering lost wages, lots of times for folks who are undocumented as well. And then looking towards, so there are lots of other things that are that are emerging out of it. But one of the things that I think is most important to think about in terms of really coming back to issues of agency is that the story of why the living wage movement became so important and is, I think, still important to analyze is because the story of the decline of the minimum wage isn't just about the decline of economic agency, but it's a decline in political agency. And that's where actually long ago my interest in campaign finance reform really dovetailed, because part of that is, okay, why are folks who are not elites, why are their voices seemingly so quiet within the political sphere? And we can see that in a lot of campaign changes in campaign finance law in the last 30 years. But that over time, the decline of the minimum wage has been a political effort to really undo its connection to inflation and things of that sort. So it was a political loss, not just kind of the laws of the economy kind of pushing it aside, but these were political choices that were made. And so I think one of the things that Occupy Wall Street really points at is that it's also naming a great inequality that is just widening as we continue, even though our productivity has gotten higher in the U.S., but CEO pay and average worker pay are just skyrocketing apart. So where they used to be much more in kind of a steady increase together, that it's exponential the way CEO, and even we see it even in the economic recovery, is that CEO pay is recovering far before average worker pay is. So I think Occupy Wall Street and the 99% is tapping into the same, very similar sentiment of, we're working, we're playing by the rules, whatever those rules were supposed to be, and we're not getting anywhere. And there's an entire class of folks who's getting somewhere by actually paying us less and less. So they're making their profits off of the decline in our wages. And then I also think there's a way in which the Occupy Wall Street and other movements is also getting at the lack of political agency and the undermining of that. So you see a lot of Occupy movements talking about campaign finance reform again, and that decisions can't be made by corporate elites. And so you get an analysis of, we don't even have the political power to speak back and be heard, even though we're in the majority. We are the 99%. So both of those, I think, speak to the intertwining of economic and political agency. And even though, again, Occupy movements are largely led by non-religious leaders in multiple cities. Hmm. Religious constituencies have been a really strong dimension of it, and particularly in Nashville. Mm-hmm. And two mm-hmm. of the 14 that were arrested in the Occupy Nashville success eventually were divinity students, mm-hmm. And who'd been working on these issues and some of the skills that they have to keep that encampment going are skills that they've learned from an intentional Christian community that they've been in. So there are ways in which there are religious stories out there mm-hmm. that I think also still need to be told that they haven't. But I think the biggest thing that connects them, living wage kind of worker justice movements with Occupy movements, is the sense of the decline of economic political agency in the U.S. And how it's not something that naturally occurred, but there were political choices that were made that these movements think need to be reversed as well.
Thank you, Melissa. This has been a very interesting conversation.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate it.
Again, I've been talking with Melissa Snar, Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at the Divinity School and Associate Professor of Ethics and Society, about her recently published book, All You That Labor, Religion and Ethics in the Living Wage Movement, part of New York University Press's Religion and Social Transformation series. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Contact Us link at the bottom of the page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.